Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the last session of the October 2021 Advocacy Sector Conversation Series. My name is Melissa Hale and I'm the coordinator of the Disability Advocacy Resource Unit. I would like to begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which I'm coming to you from today, and pay my respect to their elders past and present. I extend that respect to all First Nations people here today. Once again, we are delivering the Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum to you online. We hope at some stage soon to be able to deliver this series face-to-face when it's safe to do so in an inclusive and accessible way. However, we hope you've all settled in comfortably and are ready to settle in for the last session of the series. We encourage your active participation today, so please type your questions in the Q&A box, and at the end of the session, I'll be facilitating a Q&A session with our presenters. The last session for this series is on supported disability accommodation and supported independent living packages. Your home, your life, your choice. The way we think about housing has changed rapidly with the development of specialist disability accommodation and in relation to supported independent living. Join me in listening to Jamie Lee Dwyer, Belinda Aiken, and Kathy Bucolo from Summer Foundation to hear their experience of SDA and SIL as they share some hot tips and what they've learned so far. They'll talk about the National Disability Insurance Agency's person-centred approach to planning and decision-making as outlined in the Home and Living Support Policy, how to apply, what evidence you need, and getting the language right. So please give a warm welcome to Jamie Lee, Belinda and Kathy.
Hi, everyone, and thank you, Melissa, for that lovely welcome. And thank you all for having us here today to talk with you. My name is Belinda Aiken, and I'm a lived experience facilitator at the Housing Hub. I have lived experience in finding my own housing and living independently. And I'd always wanted to have my own place, as most people do when they reach adulthood. But I had resigned myself to this never happening for me. That was until a chance encounter with a social worker at a Melbourne hospital who told me about specialist disability accommodation. And as a result of that, I now live in my own apartment in Melbourne's inner city and have access to the support and community that I need to live the life that I want to. But even after moving into my new apartment, that journey hasn't always been easy for me. And I will discuss that further later in this presentation. But for now, I'll hand over to Jamie Lee Dwyer to tell you about her journey.
I'm Jamie Lee, and I live in my own SDA. And I love it. It was somewhere I thought I couldn't move, but I'm so very glad that I didn't move at the time I did. And I'll let you know more about that later on. Now I'd like to hand over to Kathy. Kathy?
I'm Kathy Bucolo. Great, just checking that you could see me. So I'm Kathy Bucolo. My role at the Summer Foundation is the National Practice Lead, Clinical Practice Lead. This means I do a lot of work in the areas of the NDIS, housing, SDA, support, health, discharge from hospital, and lots of bits and bobs. My background is as a speech pathologist in the acquired brain injury field, and I've been at the Summer Foundation for 5.5 years. I've also worked as an intake advocate for DAIS, who are now Regional Disability Advocacy Service in Albury-Wodonga, way back in 2014. So I'm really excited to be with you all today. So what are we going to do today? We're going to just talk you through a little bit of what the Summer Foundation is and talk about housing and support and changing the way that we think. SDA and SIL in terms of the NDIA policy and what Jamie Lee, Belinda and I have learnt so far. And then as Melissa said, we'll have a question and answer at the end. So I'll hand over to Belinda now to tell you about the Summer Foundation.
So the Summer Foundation was established in 2006 by Di Winkler with the goal of solving the issue of people with disability aged under 65 being forced to live in aged care because there was no other housing options for them. Di established the Summer Foundation after becoming frustrated by the lack of appropriate housing support for young people with disability who had been admitted to nursing homes. At Summer Foundation, we believe that, just like everyone else, adults with disability should have the right to choose where they live, who they live with, and how they live. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Housing Hub as well. And the Housing Hub is an initiative of the Summer Foundation. It is a way for people with disability to find suitable housing, and it advertises properties from a range of housing providers and also hosts a library of useful information about housing options and planning your move. It was created by the Summer Foundation as a pilot project in 2017 with funding from the Department of Social Services, or DSS, Sector Development Fund. In its first year, the Housing Hub expanded from a few small regions to include housing located in many states across Australia. As a nationwide platform, housing providers from anywhere in Australia can list their properties. And properties may include existing SDA properties, new SDA builds, non-SDA supported accommodation, private rental, properties for sale, and MTA or STA housing. And more properties are listed on the Housing Hub each week. Housing providers, including developers of specialist disability accommodation, can advertise their properties for free by signing up to the Housing Hub. And as well as connecting housing seekers with suitable housing, the Housing Hub plays an essential role in capturing the sorts of housing people are seeking, so that information about housing demand can be provided to government and developers, which leads to more accessible housing builds. So I'm now going to hand back to Cathy to take us through our next section.
Thanks, Belinda. So see this slide? It's a pretty plain slide. There's some words on it. There's no controversial photos on it. There's no swear words on it. It's just a slide. People, read this slide. Housing and the NDIS and support and the NDIS. And they start big sighing. They cross their arms. They have visions of S48s and S100s. They say weird things like, but it cannot be a review of a reviewable decision. And if they're really revved up, they talk about SIL rosters of care, how many millimetres are a doorway, OOA, ILO, SDA, HPS, IL, ROC. And they say weird words like robust. Who has ever said the word robust until now? There's none of all that on this slide. It's just a slide. I read this slide. Housing and the NDIS and support and the NDIS. I hear birds singing, a little babbling brook. It's like a musical in my head. Your problem today is that you are stuck with us and our relentless optimism about housing and support and the NDIS. But you're lucky, because if we were face to face, we'd probably make you sit through a 4-hour workshop. So you only have to put up with us for an hour today. So, we're no strangers to the immense difficulty and frustration you will have all experienced in relation to housing, support, and the NDIS. We really get it, it's our bread and butter. But our excitement and positivity comes from this image here. It shows the change over the years in relation to housing for people with disability, as well as the key features of through the decades. There's been a move from the medical institutionalized housing in the 70s to person-centered support provided as required through the years from 2000 to 2020. To bring us now is centered around our obligation to uphold the rights of people with disability, particularly their tenancy rights in this context, and the expectation to separate the provision of housing from the provision of support and to provide a range of housing options. The NDIS's view and our view is that contemporary models of housing move towards people living in smaller settings, away from larger group homes, in age-appropriate settings, so not in aged care, and with genuine choice over who provides their supports and how the support is provided. Housing will look modern, equitable, and people are living in the community. So this change in housing that we're talking about is fundamental. It seems so obvious when you talk about it and you think, oh yeah, I get it, no problem. People with disability, they have the right to housing that meets their needs. No one wants to live in an institution. People shouldn't be made to live with other people they don't want to live with. They should be able to choose and control what happens to them, around them. I got it. It's easy. But then I had one of those life-changing moments, life-changing conversations with a colleague in 2016, right before I started at the Summer Foundation. We were talking about a new housing development that was happening, which was 5 individual units where one person would live in each of the units and the shared support would be in the middle. I thought this sounded awesome, but I was curious about a practical thing. How are they going to get their shopping done? And I asked him, so will there be a van or a car to take everybody shopping? And he looked at me and with a smile, he said, it's not like that, Kath. People are going to move into their own place, have their own support they need, and choose when they need it. And they won't be forced to meet other tenants in the other units, to go shopping at a set time with strangers in a car or in a van. They'll go shopping when they want to, using transport they've organised and chosen and feel comfortable with. And like anyone else, I was, I'm embarrassed to say, blown away by my own thinking and attitude. That was the turning point for me, and I started to see the change that was coming. Before the NDIS, most disability housing vacancies were managed by the government. Across Australia, the government owned and funded disability housing and the supports. It was mostly all shared living with large numbers of people grouped together. After the NDIS, funding for housing now sits with the person. It's individualised. The organisation doesn't get block funded to run a house. The person themselves is funded in their NDIS plan for housing and the supports. And they're asked to go out into the market and find housing like everyone else. The housing market has the potential to create many options to choose from in lots of different great locations. But as you know, we're not quite there yet, are we? Our problem is that tension right there, isn't it? There's the future we can just see, but it needs to be created, versus the urgent need for suitable housing right now. I believe we are all very competent and we can do both. We can work to bring that future closer and we can work in the reality of today. So my experience of SDA and SIL and the evidence that's needed is that the language that we use is important. Sometimes it's important as it reflects that we're upholding people's rights and dignity, and sometimes it's important because it can mean the difference between being funded for a support and not being funded for a support. So in terms of people's rights, the word accommodation brings to mind facilities, institutions, large shared living. It also sounds temporary and that it's owned and run by someone else. It's not yours. It's for a holiday. We talk about student accommodation. We'd love to see everyone move away from this old language and talk about housing for people with disability. We all holiday in accommodation, but we live in housing. The word SDA, Specialist Disability Accommodation, unfortunately has got the word accommodation in it, and we can't do anything about that. So housing leads to talking about the word tenant. Resident, client, patient, is participant, all perfectly fine in various contexts. But sometimes you can use the word tenant instead, and it can really change the conversation and the situation. A tenant reads an agreement, decides if they agree, and signs it. A tenant has rights. A tenant might have housemates and is a housemate. And there's another great word for us, housemate. Housemates are interviewed and we suss them out and they're chosen. Housemates are allowed to move in for a trial and then kicked out if it doesn't work. Housemates have a say in how the house is set up and how everything works. The house is theirs, even if they're renting it. And then tenants and housemates, well, they're not placed anywhere, are they? This phrase, placing someone into accommodation, says it all, doesn't it? The person has no choice, no control. Others are making the decisions for them. Instead, what do? We find a house, we move in, we look for housing. People are housing seekers. They're in charge. They lead the process. They make the decisions. Another great option to use the words dwelling or building instead of place as well. And finally, it's been so common to talk about people with disability with what we might call passive language. So this very much sounds like things are being done to them. They're being fed, being showered. You can hear how the person is passive and things are being done to them versus the person eats or showers with support, or the person receives support versus the person engages support. So that was in terms of the person's rights. Some language in terms of SDA and what we're talking about today and SIL. So many of us have used the term fully accessible to describe a bathroom or a house. Now, one of the SDA design categories is actually called fully accessible. Unfortunately, I've seen situations where OT reports have used the term fully accessible, little f, little a, with fully as an adjective, and the person needed high physical support SDA design category. But because of the term fully accessible was used as a description in the report, the person only received fully accessible SDA funding. So now I always recommend to just never use the term fully accessible unless you actually mean capital F, capital A, and you're talking about the SDA design category. For everything else, you can say highly accessible, very accessible, really, really accessible, or just accessible. And my last hot tip is about how you talk about the support. So many people's needs are described as 24/7 support. You hear it all the time. This is a sure way to putting a person onto a path of shared living with other people with disability. And if SDA is considered, it quickly means house 3 residents, group home 4 residents, 5 residents. This isn't always what the person wants. And even if it is, what does 24/7 support mean? The staff at the Summer Foundation and many health practitioners I've worked with over the last 5.5 years around Australia all know what's going to come next if they say to me, Jane needs 24/7 support. It goes something like this. Really, I say, do they need someone right next to them 24 hours a day? I'm very annoying, hey? Yes, they do, they say. They need a lot of support. Really, I say, they need someone right next to them who is awake all night while they sleep? Oh no, not while they sleep. Okay, so they need someone right next to them 16 hours a day and a sleepover shift for 8 hours overnight. Yeah, that's better. That's it, they say. And so I say, so for 16 hours, what's the support worker actually doing? Well, Jane needs a 3-hour shift in the morning for support with personal care, brekkie, getting ready for the day. And then she needs support to make lunch and do some chores for 2 hours. And then she needs 3 hours for dinner to do a hobby and contact her family and get ready for bed. Ah, okay, I say. So that's 8 hours of planned one-to-one support that Jane definitely needs. So now we've got 8 hours of person-to-person support for physical assistance, setup and prompting for tasks, and an 8-hour sleepover shift. What does Jane need the other 8 hours of the day? Well, she needs someone right there in case she falls or if something goes wrong or an emergency or she drops something. Great. And does that support need to be in her dwelling? And take notice of the language here. In her dwelling, her home, without support, or could the supports be close by? Oh, yeah, she definitely could stay as long as they were really close by. Okay, so how close? Does she need them within, say, 3 to 5 minutes? Yeah, that'd be great, they say. One last question. This sleepover shift, does it need to be in her dwelling or can that be close by too? Close by is fine as long as she could contact them. Fantastic. So she knows when she needs help and she can call for it using some kind of technology. Yep, exactly. All right, so Jane needs 8 hours of planned person-to-person support every day for physical assistance, setup, prompting. She needs an 8-hour sleepover shift that can be close by outside her dwelling. And for the rest of the time, when she's alone in her dwelling, which could be up to another 8 hours a day, she needs a support worker close by within 3 to 5 minutes for when she needs short bursts of support. That's it, they say. So now if we think about SDA, actually a group home and a house doesn't really meet her needs. It would almost be over-supporting her. There'd be a support worker in her dwelling all the time. She doesn't need that. But if there were, say, three villas with an office in the middle and the technology to communicate to the three villas, that could really work for her as housing. Or a house and then two villas with the office in the house and she lived in one of the villas. Or an SDA apartment that's in a residential building with another apartment that's the support worker office. And usually by now, the Summer Foundation staff member and the health practitioner, they're pretty excited about what we've just done. So hopefully this helps you understand that you can say a person needs 24/7 support, but just be really aware of what that can lead to. Or you can describe the true support they need and create that future we just talked about earlier, where people with disability live how they want, with whom they want, and where they want. So I'll hand over now to Belinda to tell us, just go through, what is SDA?
So when we talk about housing, we often talk about SDA, and we've done that quite a bit today already. But what exactly is it? So specialist disability accommodation, or SDA, refers to housing that has been specially designed or modified to suit the needs of people who have an extreme functional impairment or very high support needs. So SDA housing special features or built design supports people with disability to live more independently, safely, and to engage the supports they need each day. So the NDIS funds the cost of housing for eligible NDIS participants whose extreme functional impairment or very high support needs mean mainstream housing doesn't meet their needs. And this is estimated to be for around 6% of all NDIS participants. SEA funding under the NDIS will stimulate investment in the development of new high-quality dwellings for use by eligible NDIS participants. SDA funding is not support services, but is instead for the homes in which these services are delivered. And we use the term the bricks and mortar. The bricks and mortar will be enrolled with the NDIA, and it will be accountable to the Quality and Safeguards Commission. It is enrolled as a certain design category. So in other words, to a certain level of accessibility. And it will be that accessible, you will need SDA funding in your plan to be able to live in it. And that funding will be in the capital part of your SDIS, NDIS plan. And it's important to note that if a person has funding for SDA, they do not have funding for home modifications. And if you are funded for home modifications, you can't be funded for SDA. The SDA payment covers the cost to the SDA housing provider to complete the customization and accessibility of your SDA dwelling. And what is supported independent living, or SIL? And this is support for a person to live as independently as possible. This support, when it's called SIL, usually means shared with other participants. It's mostly support that's provided in a person's home. So one support provider will provide it to all the people sharing the SIL supports. It's on-site or it's in your actual dwelling. And you need to be approved by the NDIA for it. And it usually means you have very high support needs every day. But it doesn't pay for utilities, groceries, board, rent, property damage, etc. And it will be in a person's NDIS plan under core supports and is usually in the plan as a stated support, which means the funding for SIL can only be used by the SIL provider. And I'm going to hand back over to Kat to take us through our next section.
Traditionally, many of the group homes we all know about have the housing, the bricks and mortar, and the supports, the person-to-person support, provided by the same organisation. So have a think about this. If a person breaks things in the house, makes too much noise, clashes with other tenants, but they have the best support workers they've ever had, this is a tenancy issue, not a support issue. If the housing and support is provided by the same provider, they will lose both their housing and the great support workers. And then vice versa. If the person is abused by a support worker in terrible circumstances, or doesn't like the support worker that does the nighttime shift, or they're left in bed until 11 o'clock every day, but the house is 5 minutes from where they work part-time and their sister lives around the corner and visits every few days. This is a support issue. It's not a housing issue. But again, if they want to change supports, they'll also lose their great housing. In these types of situations, people with disability quickly feel trapped and stuck. Submissions into the Royal Commission into violence, abuse, neglect, and exploitation from people with disability outline firsthand the possible consequences of not separating housing and supports. So this is a visual representation of how we can approach moving away from traditional thinking about people with disability as a society to this more contemporary approach to housing and support. So let's think and talk about these two elements as separate. And by doing this, we're creating a future that we all want to live in. So Belinda, saying this, there's a question that's on our minds. Can you live in Silt?
So we know what this means when people say it, but if you think about the definition we just talked about, then the answer would be no, you can't live in Silt. But can you live in a Silt house? Again, we know what this means. It usually means a group home that is owned by a disability organisation, and they provide the SIL as well. And it means it is housing or a dwelling that is not enrolled as SDA housing with the NDIA. And that's really important information, because it can also mean that the housing is owned by the SIL provider. And this leads to people's choices being really impacted. Because if you want to live in that house, you have to have that support provider. And we do have a position paper on this on our website if you'd like to read more about that. So instead of living in a SIL house, we would prefer to say you live in or are searching for non-SDA disability housing with SIL. So everyone knows that the person doesn't need SDA funding, but they do need SIL funding. And there are risks involved with that type of housing and support model, as we just talked about. So one last question. Do you have to live in SDA or non-SDA disability housing to be approved for SIL? And the answer to that is no. Because two or more NDIA participants could live in a private rental or social housing, or a caravan, or an Airbnb, or a service apartment in a hotel, and they would both still have SIL funding. So I'm going to hand back over to Kath now to take us through our next section.
Thank you. So I'm going to take you through some different options for housing a person can live in and some support models using this contemporary language and concepts. So many of you are going to be aware of these, and I'm certainly not presenting them as new ideas, but it's just to really reinforce, let's not default to any housing and support approach. Let's instead first think about the person. What are their housing needs and preferences? What are their support needs and preferences? And how could those two things come together to meet the person's needs and desires? And then what funding would they need? So the first example is, for want of a better term, where the person is living in mainstream housing, we'll call it, and has core supports. So the person is living alone, with other people without disability. The housing is mainstream and could be your own home, private rental, public housing, community housing. The supports are in the plan as core supports, assistance with daily living, or could be ILO. The person chooses any provider they want for their assistance with daily living and their community access, and the housing provider as such is separate to the support provider. So the next one is the same in terms of the housing. So we're still talking about mainstream housing. Now, the person lives with other people with disability. The housing is the same as we said, private rental, own home, public housing, community housing, or NRAS. The support is in the plan as core supports, SIL assistance with daily living. So all the tenants have one support provider for the SIL. They can have each of their own provider for community access, or sometimes they just use all the one provider. And again, the housing provider is separate from the support provider. The next example is non-SDA disability housing and SIL. So now the person is living with other people with disability. The housing is non-SDA disability housing. The supports are in the plan as under core supports as SIL. All the tenants would usually have one SIL provider. They may have their own community access provider, or they may just all use the same provider. And the housing provider now may be separate, or it could be the same as the support provider organisation. And our next example, now we've moved into the housing being SDA. So the person is living with other people with disability. The housing is SDA. The supports are in the plan as core supports SIL. All the tenants have one support provider for SIL. They could each have their own for community access or not. The housing provider may be separate or the same as the support provider. And I'd note that this is the common way, but we'd really encourage you to all think about, are there other ways that you could think to do this housing and support model that would still uphold people's rights and their choice and control over their lives? Could some of the support be SIL and some be in their core supports? If three people live together, could two people share supports and one doesn't because they really want to be housemates but they want different support providers? We really know this is a complex to implement, but I think this is our time to really challenge ourselves. Could we really uphold people's rights and their choice and do this kind of housing? And the last one, which personally is for me the most exciting, is when there's SDA, there's SIL, and there's core supports. So we've got the combo. So this is pretty new still. The person is living alone or with partner, family, friends, a person without disability. The housing is SDA. And for this option, if it's easier to picture, you can picture 10 apartments peppered throughout a residential building or 6 apartments peppered throughout a building. It could also work for 3 villas that are near each other. It could also work for a house and then 2 villas near each other as an example. So you're imagining that the tenants live alone or with others without disability, each in their dwelling. And those dwellings are near each other, and there's some shared support very close by. So the supports are in the plan. Some supports are in the plan as SIL, and that's for that shared component. But some supports are also in the plan, as core supports, that person can choose whatever provider they want. That all the tenants involved could choose the on-site provider, the one that they're sharing, and they can do whatever they like for community access, choose any provider. And here the SDA provider, the housing provider, ideally again is separate to the support providers. So if that's a bit confusing or we've got Q&A time, go for it, write your questions there. So I've got one last slide, just to take you through that the NDIA Act gives effect to Article 19 of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So this talks about that persons with disabilities have the opportunity to choose their place of residence and where and with whom they live on equal basis with others and are not obliged to live in a particular living arrangement. Also, persons with disabilities have access to a range of in-home, residential, and other community support services, including personal assistance, necessary to support living and inclusion in the community and to prevent isolation or segregation from the community. So the NDIA is addressing this by establishing a home and living policy that you may have heard of, which is described as person-centred and with the aim of giving participants more choice and control over where they live, who they live with, and the supports they use. The policy covers housing, housing-related supports, assistive tech, and home mods. The NDIA recently consulted with people with disability in the sector to support the design and the implementation of this policy. So once this is finalised, it'll give us all a really great picture of the NDIA's role in funding home and living supports for people. I'll now hand it back to Belinda and JL, who will finish up our portion of today and let you know about their experience of SDA and SIL. And we'll hear from Belinda first.
Thanks, Kathy. So I mentioned earlier that my journey hasn't always been easy, and that continued after I moved into my new apartment. In fact, that started a couple months before I moved in. See, I'd never had support workers before. It was always my mother who helped me with my day-to-day activities. So having any outside help was very new to me. In the SDA that I moved into, used the SIL model of support. And that meant one support provider provided both my daily living supports and the shared support component. But I didn't really think too much about this at first, as I knew little about having support workers. But that changed not long after I moved in, after I had a meeting with the new support provider. They seemed very controlling, to the point that they even told me that I would have no choice and control over who worked with me. And this raised many red flags. But my problem was I'd already agreed to use this company as part of the conditions of moving into my apartment. And I did search advocates around this time. However, because I only had a physical disability, I thought no advocate would take me on. And I had a voice, only I wasn't in the practice of using it to stick up for myself. Besides, I should be grateful that I had a place to live and was specially designed around me, right? And I was grateful for that. But no one should ever have to be grateful for a support model that doesn't meet their needs. And what I found when I moved into my new apartment was a group home model transplanted into the new SDA apartment housing. And our support times were regimented, and often we weren't allowed to change them because it would interfere with the rostering with other tenants. And rostering was a major issue that continued throughout. The provider would constantly try to put support workers on my shifts that weren't trained in my routines or I wasn't comfortable with. And no one should ever have to put up with that. The way support is delivered in SDA should be up to the tenant. To provide maximum choice and control, the daily living component of a person's care should be up to the individual and not the choice of the SDA provider. It took me over a year of complaining to both the support provider and the NDIS Safeguards Commission to get control of my one-to-one supports. But I did get there, and now I run my own team of support workers. And we also have a new support provider running the shared support component here, and they seem to be more person-centred, which I think is really good. So most SDA apartments have a support model that allows a tenant to bring their own supports and use whatever provider they want for their one-to-one supports. However, there are still places where a group home model is used. So if you do come across people who aren't happy with the support model that is in their SDA property, know that you can help them to change it. And it's very important that people know their rights, and when and how they get their support is a fundamental part of those rights. So I'm going to now hand over to Jamie Lee to take us through her experiences.
Thanks. Hey, come on, me. Hey, come on, I had a really good told me about a new building in the city with SDA included, and I didn't really know a whole lot about what I was getting into. But I really wanted to move at where I was in the group home. So, it was really a leap of faith for me, but obviously now you don't need that because a lot more people, especially at summer, know exactly how it all works. So I wasn't sure whether I would be able to fit any of my equipment in here, things like my ceiling hoist, my power chair. I have a room where I keep everything in here now, and I've got my own ceiling hoist in here, which is really, really good. So I didn't know whether I could be financially responsible for moving out of the group home, which works out I can, because my rent is only 25% of the disability support pension I can afford everything else. So I live in the city, and I live in a building with able-bodied people and disabled people, meaning the new model of SDA is all about integration and not segregation, which I feel like most group homes are all about segregating disabled people from designing. So my support team, my personal support team, Not the ones that work here on site. They are a lot more flexible with my needs, which means, for example, I write with fewer of them and a scribe, so I dictate to them and they help me write because I was having a lot of trouble writing when I was at the group home. And because it's something I love to do, I wasn't really able to write what I wanted, and so now I can, which is really great. I'm no longer limiting to do anyone's rules, which means I knew what I want when I want. Like a lot of young people, I love living here in my very own bachelorette pad. It's really cool. And I seriously encourage anyone who thinks they can't move out because their needs are too high to move as well. I get all the care I need, which is great. Yeah. And now I'll hand over to Kathy.
Thank you. Thanks, Belinda and Jael. So fantastic to hear from you both and finish our presentation today on both of your experiences. And now we're done. You can see our contact details there, and I'll hand back to Melissa.
Wow, Kathy, I have to say you made our team crack up laughing with your plain slide about housing and the NDIS and supporting the NDIS and people's reaction to it with sighs and crossed arms because it's just so sadly real. And it's moments like this I wish we could all be face to face so I could see the room chuckling along with us. So thank you very much to all of you, and particularly for Belinda and Jamie Lee for sharing your personal stories. It's really quite mind-blowing to see the illusion of choice and control rather than actual choice and control, particularly the fight that strong women like yourselves had to go through. Makes me wonder about people who aren't as strong and what they're going through as well. So I think before we go to questions, the first thing I'd like to highlight is that the slides and recording for this session will be available on the Dowry website as usual. So we'll go to questions and answers now. We'll pop them up on the screen. So can we have the link to the petition paper that the still-owned housing Belinda had just mentioned? And Maida would be interested to endorse this and add to our own petition paper in the future through our systemic work. So when would we be able to find that petition paper?
Yeah, thank you so much. That's fantastic. Yeah, really easy. If you go to the Summer Foundation website, and then look for under resources related to policy and look for the policy there. But also, Melissa, if you'd like to, we can send you that link and you can send it to the participants or whatever works best.
Yep, we'll make a resource page with the recording of this. We can put that on the resource page as well. Thanks.
Great.
So is the home modification for housing through the assistive technology process? So I assume that means about NDIS funding. So if someone wanted to make home modification, can they do that through assistive technology?
Yeah, it's a bit of a funny thing. The answer is yes. So, assistive technology, and sorry if you already know this, but if you think of it as the broad umbrella term, and then under that are a whole different levels. So the highest, biggest level is for home mods. So you're right, under assistive technology, you'd apply for home modifications. And then the levels you imagine can go right down to if you needed a non-slip mat for your bench, that's also an assistive technology process. But I think what the point that as well that Belinda was making was that if you've got home mods funding, you can't get SDA funding as well.
Okay, great. Next question. If more than one person with a disability shares a house, would they need to have CIL funding in their NDIS plans, or could they simply use their core funding in their NDIS plans?
Great question. Belinda, do you have anything to say about that?
My experience, well, I do live alone, so I don't share with anyone else, and I've never shared with anyone else, so I don't necessarily know what is in funding for or in their plans for supports when you do share a house. But usually, if you are in a share house, you do normally need CIL funding as well, I believe. Is that correct, Kathy? I think it's something like that. I know I have CIL funding in my plan. I live alone, but I also have core funding for my one-to-one supports. So my CIL funding is for the shared support component, which it was. I've got five other tenants. So there's five other tenants in their own apartments in this building. We all share shared support, and that comes under CIL funding. So I think any support that's shared between people, I think, falls under CIL funding. Is that correct, Kath? I think it works that way.
Yeah, you're spot on. And Jamie Lee, I wasn't sure, did you want to add something?
Yeah. I was contemplating moving out with friends, and we were talking about sale, and one of my friends was telling us that she didn't have enough, so she couldn't use her core. But then it would mean that she wouldn't run out of money for her day-to-day. So you can, but it's better to have more for your one-on-one.
Yeah, great. Thank you both. Yeah, great. You've both answered it. It's kind of a usually yes, but if that's not what you want, we'd probably all three of us would say, give it a good go.
Yeah, it just seems like a very creative budgeting. That's what it looks like to me. Next question. All households do that. Do you have any ideas on how people can learn about their rights if they're in an SDA that doesn't allow advocates access, which happens quite often, sadly?
Wow. Can I throw to one of you to answer that?
Yeah,
Yeah,
objection.
the new provider. Hermione, no, Melina.
Yeah, I just want to say it surprised me that some SCAs don't allow advocates access. I think that's just wrong. But I mean, you can learn about, I mean, we have resources at the Housing Hub and Summer Foundation that does list what your rights are. And we do have different workshops and webinars listed on our site as well that will take you through what your rights are in SCA, in SIL, and in other areas as well. I think we do have some great resources that can help you with that. Do you have any other suggestions, maybe, Kat, that where people can find out more?
Yeah, thanks. That's great. So we're talking about, Belinda's talking about the housing hub that she told you about. So if you go to that resources page, also the Summer Foundation website resources page. I'd also say if a house or a dwelling is SDA, that means it's been enrolled with the NDIS and is accountable to the Quality and Safeguards Commission. So, you'd be calling, and this is assuming that the person can do this, and this might be sort of the complexity of this question, I imagine, as well. But Quality and Safeguards Commission is another option. And if you happen to live in Victoria, I'll just add the consumer rights website has really good tenancy information about SDA. I haven't seen that for the other states, so I'm sorry about that. But yeah, if you again, we can give you that link if you happen to live in Victoria. It's really great info.
Great. I think we'll go to the last question because we've got lots of questions coming through. So, one more.
We needed the 4-hour workshop.
Typically, how long does it take to receive approval for SDA SIL funding from the NDIS? I realise there will be requirements to fulfil, but an approach would be helpful.
Thank you for asking me this question. I was hoping somebody would. So the really useful thing to know is, as you may or may not know, the NDIS has operational guidelines. There's an SDA operational guideline. So if you Google that, you can find it. And about halfway down, there's a tiny little sentence that says, once the SDA panel has your evidence, they will try to make their SDA decision within 10 days. So you want to take that sentence and run with it, and use that in your very strong advocacy. Anecdotally, and probably in our work with the NDIA, we hear that the expectation for SIL is, you often hear 4 to 6 weeks is what they would like. I think if we asked all our, participants here today, that's certainly not what we see happening on the ground. It takes a lot longer. Yeah, and with SDA, our other hot tip would be, particularly if the person's in hospital or in aged care, that when you're sending in your home and living form, with your participant housing statement, your functional capacity assessment from an OT, and a behaviour support plan if you're going for robust housing, that you also in the subject of that email write urgent person is in hospital or urgent person is in aged care to get people's attention.
So I can
We
just
could
see
keep
advocates
going.
now scrambling to find that sentence right now and going to run with it. But everybody, we've come to a close of this last session of this series. So I'd like really thank you, Jamie Lee, Belinda, and Kathy from the Summer Foundation for your time to bring this presentation to us today. A very important topic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you also to the Auslan interpreters and captioners for their hard work today. Thank you to Show Division for bringing this production to you today. Have a wonderful week, everyone. We'll see you next time.